Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Saha Vīryam Karavāvahai, Tejasvinavatitamastu Mā Vidvishāvahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. First chapter, second volume, verse 24. Na Vivataha. Yeah. We have two verses left in this volume. Na viratoh duscharitam, na shanto na samahitah, na shantamanasovapi, na shantamanasovapi, prajnane nainamaknuyat, prajnane nainamaknuyat, na aviratah. Duscharitat, na ashantaha, na samahitaha, na ashantamanasaha, va api, prajnanena, enam, apniyat. In the previous verse, we were talking about the adhikari, the one who is qualified for this knowledge, and how this knowledge is attained. That was the last verse. Now, for the others, those who are not qualified for this knowledge, whose mind is such that it's not available for this knowledge. But the qualification, it's not like qualification for a job or something. The qualification has to do with your own interest, really. The degree of interest, the degree of recognition of the problem to even make you want this knowledge. So that's what we're talking about, qualifications. In fact, there's two qualifications. One is pravritti, the qualifications for samsara, and the other is qualifications for liberation, for moksha. The qualifications for the samsara is that you still feel that your happiness, your well-being, your completion as a human being can be gained through fulfilling desires in the world. You know, fulfilling desires positively and negatively, getting rid of the things that you don't want and acquiring the things that you do want. And that acquisition and also getting rid of things, the acquiring and getting rid of things, also it has to do on every level. It has to do with the acquiring of things that are external to me. It has to do with acquiring the type of health, the body that I want, the looks that I want. It has to do with the type of mind that I want, the type of thoughts that I want. I'll be happy if I have these thoughts. I have to get rid of these kind of thoughts. I'll be happy if I'm thin, because I'm unhappy because I'm fat. It is literally endless. Endless. Modifications of desire. If I could only have this or only have that, then I would attain happiness. And then we also find if I have this, but also this and also this, then I have a network of things. And if I could have those things, then maybe I would be whole and complete. Or if I could work to go to heaven, to Swarga Loka, then that would complete me. So that's even going outside of this loka, the states of existence I can achieve after death if I follow Dharma and do the right amount of tapas and punyas and austerities, I may be able to get to a heaven world. So this is still in the realm of samsara, to the degree, if I believe that I can complete myself or gain a state where I can say, now I am free, all is well with me, I have achieved what a human being is meant to achieve. I'm now a full and complete being. As long as I believe that that can be attained within time and space, within duality, then I'm classified as a samsari. And the first part of the Vedas, the Karmakanda, is what is the scripture, the Vedic scripture that speaks to me and is for me. How to follow Dharma? How can I achieve the maximum amount of happiness within duality? That's the first part of the Vedas. So if I still feel that is what I, the maximum of what I can achieve, is what I can be following the Vedas, what can be achieved within time and space, then it's, I'm sorry. If I have recognized that what I can achieve within samsara are only time-bound results. Time-bound results and therefore time-bound happiness. Right? I can even say time-bound happiness and sorrow, time-bound pleasure and pain. But there is no possibility of attaining a state of being where I can just say all is well with me and I can forget about it. I am whole, I am complete. There is nothing that can be done about that. I have achieved that. I recognize that's not possible. And so then, because every human being, every being really, seeks to be whole and complete, then I wonder, this is what makes me into mumukshu, is there any way that I can actually be whole and complete? That I can actually feel, now I have done what needs to be done, I am whole and complete. Is there any way that I, or is there any part of me that survives death? So these questions become real questions once I realize that within duality, I can't achieve any of these things. I'm not going to be free from birth and death. I'm not going to be free from change. All of my acquisitions are going to be temporary. So once I realize the limitations of this, then I start asking or throwing my hands up to Ishwara, if you're there, please help me, because I realize that I can't achieve what I need to achieve from the creation. So then, that's what we're talking about, qualifications. It depends on the amount of assimilation, the amount of assimilation of experience I have done. Right? So, samsara, if I think I can make everything all right within time and space. The desire for liberation, if I realize that that's not possible. If I realize that's not possible, and then I want to gain, I want to know, you know, or I become a seeker of that, wondering, is there such a thing, where that becomes a real question, then I become what's called a mumukshu, someone who desires liberation because now I feel bound by samsara, because I realize that it really can't give me what I want. So it becomes a bondage for me from which I want liberation. So moksha is really moksha from the bondage of samsara. It's moksha from, you could say it's moksha from change, it's moksha from continual transmigration, it's moksha from being bound by time, basically. And every experience I have is really time bound. So that desire for liberation, which we call mumuksha, that's a desiderative in Sanskrit, mumuksha. It means moktum icha, the desire for moksha. Moksha from suffering, basically. Moksha from dukkha, from suffering. And so then, that's what we mean by somebody who has those qualifications. So, So now, the thing is, a person who has that desire, because they have assimilated experience, there's certain things that change, that there's certain things that change in the psyche of a person who has realized the limitations of samsara. Right? And those changes are what we call the sadhana chatushtya. It means that group of fourfold sadhanas, or by sadhanas here they mean qualifications of the mind. Qualifications of the mind for being available for this knowledge. That's what we mean by qualifications. So the first two qualifications are the viveka and vairagya, where the viveka is just simply recognizing the time-bound nature of the creation and that it can't give me something that is stable or permanent. The second qualification is called vairagya. Vairagya means that because I'm not able to gain what as a human being I'm seeking from the creation, because I've recognized the truth of that, right, I gain a dispassion. In other words, I change now. My passion changes. It gets dampered a little bit because I no longer have that drive to become whole and complete through my acquisitions or through my accomplishments in the world. That doesn't mean I don't stop trying to accomplish. It's just that I don't feel the same way about it because I no longer feel that that's really what I need to become a whole and complete being, to become full. And so even though I'm still doing it, I do all of these things because I'm alive, I don't do it in order to become whole and complete because I've seen the fallacy of that. And so that, viveka and vairagya, give me some space in my psyche, because now my raga and dvesha, my likes and dislikes in the form of I need this to be happy, I must have this to be happy, and I must get rid of this to be happy, positive and negative, my likes and dislikes, where I'm projecting my happiness on the world and then desperately going after trying to fulfill these things, that gets dampered in a sense, which gives my mind a different relationship with the world. Now I have some space, and my commitment to Dharma, also just within the Shastra and within the tradition, within the Vedic tradition, even to have the space, the inner space, to ask the who am I question, or to have the inner space to recognize that I can really not attain anything permanent from the world. It's not possible. So I'm always going to be juggling. I'm always going to be accruing punya and papa, dharma, dharma. But that, what, even to have the inner space to become reflective like that is considered a great punya. Means it's a gift from Bhagavan. It's a deserved gift from Bhagavan. For punya means the positive results from my actions on a subtle level. So to accrue that punya, to have the space to ask these questions, already means that you've lived lifetime after lifetime after lifetime of dharmic behavior. So you already have a commitment to Dharma just by the mere fact of having that mumukshutvam. So the Shastra says that Dharma itself gives an inner space, because Dharma is a really commitment to ahimsa, to non-injury to all beings. It's basically what it is. It's the golden rule, do unto others as I would do to myself, where I'm able to take this innate knowledge of how I would like to be treated that really does not have to be taught. It's innate. Dharma is innate in terms of how I want to be treated. So I can be very dharmic to myself, and I expect all of you to be very dharmic toward me. Because this is, I know, this is how I want to be treated. But there's an empathy that has to take place. And also that empathy in a healthy human being is there. It does take place. To where I recognize that how I would like to be treated is how you would like to be treated also, in terms of kindness and care and benefit of the doubt and help being helpful and all of these type of things, because I want to be treated that way. I can I can feel quite certain that you also want to be treated in that way. What gets in the way of that is raga dvesha, my likes and dislikes. The raga dvesha are born of ignorance, because raga dvesha requires a projection of my ananda, of my happiness, onto the world. It requires literally a projection of my own being onto the world and then running after it. But if I am projecting my own essential nature onto the world, that is pretty serious. That's serious, because I'm taking myself to be out here and I have to get it back. And so I have a desire to get myself back, even though I don't know that that's what it is. But that just tells you how very serious it is. Myself has been projected out there and I need to get it back. And that desire to get it back is often stronger than dharma, than my empathy. The dharma is never at stake in terms of how you should all treat me, but in reference to my desire to get myself back, either in a positive desire or a negative desire, there's a competition there, and sometimes I will, as though, put blinders on around what is appropriate action, what is dharmic action, because of the passion to fulfill this particular desire. And that creates a lot of internal conflict and internal problems, and it creates a lack of shanti, a lack of inner peace. And so with this lack of inner peace, I don't have reflective inner space. I'm just working away, trying to get what I need to be happy. And sometimes, even though for most of us the dharma is still there, but sometimes it just takes a back seat. And then so that I find my mind getting more and more encumbered with stress and all of these type of things. The one, because of crores and crores of punya, as it says in the Viveka Chudamani, so I'm not really just giving the tradition to you, crores and crores of punya, because of dharma, because of lifetimes of dharma, the mind has some space where the commitment to dharma is greater than the commitment to raga dvesha. That also takes assimilation of experience. When the commitment to dharma is greater than raga dvesha, it's because of my experience. I've experienced time and again in so many ways that if ever I transgress dharma in order to fulfill a raga dvesha, even though I get some kind of pleasure, there's suffering underneath that negates it, that makes it not worth it. Whereas when I do the dharma at the expense of the raga dvesha, there is a depth of shanti underneath that makes that worth it. So I've experienced this for lifetimes and lifetimes until finally dharma wins. And in that space, I have a lot of room, I have a lot of shanti, because raga dvesha are no longer ruling my life. And that gives me that space for that self-reflection and that mumukshutvam. And it gives me a different kind of mind. And that kind of mind is talked about in this, what we call the samadhi shatka, this sixfold group of mental qualifications. I'm telling you all of this because this next verse is going to negate all this. This verse that we're doing. Okay, so the sixfold qualifications. The first one is shama, which is a wonderful attitude or wonderful strength of mind, which goes like this. We have continual thought flow, and we can have all kinds, like Swamiji once said, we have all kinds of thoughts. I have all kinds of funny thoughts. Okay? Good thoughts, bad thoughts, all kinds of thoughts just floating through. But that's what they're doing, floating through. You have a choice to act on those thoughts, engage with those thoughts, or not. So say some weirdo thought comes through that would really be to your pain and detriment to engage in it. Okay? It's not going anywhere for you. It's only going toward dukkha, towards sorrow. Okay? And so when this thought comes through, you just nicely let that go. As you would any thought that is not worth your time. It's just simply not worth engaging in because it doesn't lead to anything positive. So the ability to have that choice is what we call shama. Dhamma is the next one, which if my shama fails, and so the one thought or emotion has caught me, and now I'm embodied with it, right? Now it's something that's overwhelmed. And I can't just let it go. I can say, please go, and it just sits there. It's not going to go. It's caught me. And so dhamma is the capacity to not act it out, to be able to contain it, to be able to do inner child work with it, to have a discussion with it, rather than act it out. That's also very important. I still have some control over my mind. Right? So shama dhamma. Upadati also is the third one. When I have really realized that what I seek as a human being, what is the fundamental problem to being a human being, cannot be satisfied by the world, by my engagement with the world, I become my mumukshutvam and my jignasa, my desire to know, my desire to gain self-knowledge, becomes primary for me. As opposed to being kind of like a dilettante, like, oh, let me study this Upanishad, and then let me go do this, and let me go do that. So I'm just a little bit of this, a little bit of that, a little bit of that, because it's just, I'm dilettante, I'm interested in many, many different things, but nothing particularly deeply. But for a mumukshu, there's a commitment. I'm interested in this for the long term. That's upadati. Sometimes upadati is defined as sannyasa, whether it be guna sannyasa or vividisha sannyasa. Vividisha sannyasa means I've taken the orange and I'm living the life of a sannyasi. Guna sannyasa is I'm still living as a householder or in the world, having not taken the orange, but in terms of my value system, I'm a sannyasi. The way I live my life internally is a sannyasi. If I take the sannyasa, then I'm wearing the orange. Either way, it's fine. Sannyasa means that this is my commitment. I can also call myself a karma yogi. I'm involved in the world because I can kind of exhaust my raga dvesha in the light of my knowledge within the world. But my commitment is to knowledge, and I use the world for antakarana shuddhi, for purification of my mind. So the world becomes, like a laboratory for that. All of my experiences become a laboratory for purification of mind so that I have some inner freedom. So then there's titiksha. I gain an ability because of my jignasa, because of my desire for knowledge being primary. The world of opposites are not as crushing for me. Like, I wanted to go skiing, and it's a hot day and the snow has melted. So my whole vacation is now ruined. My life is ruined because I've spent so much time, and I can only get this time off. On and on and on and on, so everything's destroyed. Likes and dislikes. Likes and dislikes really matter. Titiksha means, okay, we can't go skiing, we'll do something else. It's okay, it doesn't matter. This is happening, it's raining, I want to be somewhere, this is fine. I'm not committed. My commitment, my ananda, my well-being is really not dependent upon the opposites, the flux of opposites. Which is a relief because you have no control over the changing phenomena. You have no control over it. So you can hope for something and hope something goes well, but that doesn't mean that it will. So what are you going to do when it doesn't fit your ideal plan? Yeah. So that seems kind of silly, but really this is the truth on subtler and subtler levels, where my ideal plan is not being fulfilled, some opposite thing has come in to destroy it. But what if I don't look at it like that? Now, if this happens, that's good. If this happens, okay, just do something else, it's fine. That's titiksha. I can do that. I can have that titiksha because my commitment is not toward these things. My commitment actually is toward self-knowledge and being free of those attitudes. And so that gives a lot of space. The last, second to the last is samadhanam. I now have a lot of, my mind has a lot of shanti and being able to focus on one thing or especially focus on this knowledge because my mind isn't running around trying to fill this desire and make this right for me and make that right for me. Whatever this is, it's Ishwara, it's fine. And so with this being Ishwara, with this being fine, I focus on my knowledge, on my nididhyasana, on my shravana, on my studies, and that because that is where my jignasa, my desire for knowledge, the mumukshutva, the desire for liberation, that's where my mind is at. And so it's capable of focus, samadhani. And the most important one, and the one that you probably have no control of at all, it's called Ishwara Anugraha, the grace of God, the grace of Ishwara, is Shraddha. Shraddha means, and it's the promise of the Shastra, actually, that if that mumukshutvam is there for real, not just, I want liberation, please give me a new car. You know, I want liberation, let me astral travel or whatever. But if mumukshutvam is mumukshutvam, you know, based upon the definition of the Shastra, you know, that I've recognized this fundamental problem, then you must meet your teacher. That must happen. It's like a law. It's like a law in the creation, just like Bhagavan made you with thirst. So there has to be something to drink, right? He made you with hunger, so there must be food. What if you had hunger and there's no such thing as food? You know? Or what if you had to breathe but there was no air? It did not exist. That's, you know. That means that there's really no relationship between the human being and the planet they find themselves in. But so also on the level of what you seek as a human being, what is fundamental, how can we win the game? Is it possible? What if it's like, there's this game, there's this fundamental desire that all beings have? Sorry, there's no solution to it. It's just, ha ha. That would be really dark. That would be really dark. So, as all the other, the infinite laws that hold this creation and the jiva and the creation together as one entity, the laws that involving, or the order involving the desire for this knowledge and the gain of this knowledge is considered a law. So when it happens that this knowledge, that this mumukshutvam arises for you at that time, then you should come in contact with this teaching. That's the Vedic understanding. And so, now Shraddha, what Shraddha means is that when that teaching occurs, or that teacher occurs, who is, which you wouldn't have any idea actually, in terms of your knowledge and your experience, whether that teacher knows what he or she is talking about. And you also wouldn't have any knowledge of where the Upanishad is really delivering the goods that will liberate you. You don't know. You won't know until you know, right? And so there's nobody really to answer that question for you. But there's something inside that gives you the go-ahead, even though you don't know. You know, something inside says yes. This feels right to me. I know it without knowing. So Swamiji calls this Shraddha, faith pending understanding, as opposed to like a blind faith. Well, you never will really know, but you just believe. And then when you die and go to heaven, you'll see whether that belief was true or not. But until then, you won't know. This is not like that. This is not what they mean by Shraddha. Shraddha means that your mind is open. You have to give an inner go-ahead to study this, to see whether it delivers the good or not, the goods or not. That openness is there. That's what they call Shraddha. So that's why it says faith pending understanding. And in some ways, though the stakes aren't as high, we do have this Shraddha in reference to many, many things, many of our undertakings. We feel this is really what we want to do, or we really want to study, you know, algebra with this teacher or whatever, you know. Even though you don't know it, it's something you have a desire for, and you go ahead with it, and you go ahead with that particular teacher. There's something that says, yes, go ahead. Those are just for small things in the world. This is bigger and more important, you know. But there's something that allows you to be open to listening. Open to listening doesn't mean saying yes to everything. It means trying to understand, a commitment to understanding. So that's what they call Shraddha. So these are the qualifications, the mental attitudes that give one the inner space to be able to gain this knowledge. So you have the Viveka, Vairagya, this group of six, and Mumukshutva. Those are the qualifications. And those qualifications understand an underlying commitment to Dharma. So now, the person who has that, you know, can gain this knowledge, and that's what the previous verse was about. Okay. Now, what about the one who doesn't have that? So what it says is, na avirataha duscharitat. Not avirataha means the one who has restraint and control. It's like Vairagya. They have strength, control, restraint, you know. Avirataha means the one who doesn't have that, who is impulsive, who cannot control, cannot keep away from prohibited actions. Bad, dush means bad, chara means behavior, charita, the way one behaves. Dush charita means bad behavior. So in Shankara's commentary, for this dush charita, he says, pratishiddhat shruti smriti avahitat. Pratishiddhat, in the shruti, in the scriptures, in the Vedas, and in the smriti, or to all of the, like the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, pratishiddha, there are behaviors, actions that are prohibited. They're all having to do with adharma. So he says, avihitat, in other words, papakarmas. So those who cannot refrain from papakarmas, from karmas, actions that cause pain to yourself or others. Karmas that are adharmic, karmas that are clearly prohibited in the Shastra. You may not know, like for instance in the West we have the Ten Commandments. You know, like there's 10 prohibited karmas, and each one of those karmas, you could have hundreds of them, you know, subcategories under each one. Okay. One great thing about Swamiji's book, Value of Values, is that these prohibited karmas or attitudes that are not good for you, he discusses one by one, so they're just not rote. Thou shalt not do this. Okay. But it's nice to understand psychologically why these things shouldn't be done. Because then you gain a value for not doing them, which is greater than whatever raga dvesha, whatever likes and dislikes comes in reference to that karma that is prohibited. And the reason it's prohibited is because it causes dukkha for you and for others. And so over the test of time, all of these scriptures in the East and in the West have made a list Human beings have made a list. Stay away from this. Stay, do this. Don't do these things. Don't do these things for sure. Don't do these. Yeah. Because if you do these things, they will hurt you. They will cause a lot of pain. But do these things. Do this. Do these things. Really do these. Do these and these and these. Because these types of behavior will give you happiness, relatively. They'll give you shanti. And so all of the different religions of the world and spiritual disciplines of the world have made lists of these do's and don'ts. So sometimes in school, when I'm teaching these Eastern theories of self, mind, and nature, I do the Sankhya Yoga and the Buddhism and the Advaita Vedanta, and then I'll do some Western things, and I just list them down, you know. And you'll see they're all about the same. Because human beings have discovered, it's been passed down, maybe we can say in the Vedas, from beginningless time, these type of behaviors are not in your best interest at all. Keep away from them. But what happens is that over the course of time, they just become a list, that you kind of a memorized list, that you may not have done very much manana, very much analysis as to why it really is not in my best interest to do all of these things. So, here, a person who is not restrained from these kind of prohibitive actions, na ashantaha, the one who doesn't have, Swamiji does this one like this, the one who doesn't have dhamma, means in terms of what you pursue through your sense organs, there's no restraint. No. And so then again, the raga dvesha are what is ruling. Whatever impulsively comes to my mind, so we'll see in the next chapter where we're using this example of a chariot. You know, a person who doesn't have dhamma, it's like the reins of the chariot are just let go. You know, and the horses are just going. There's no reins there. You know, the horses are the sense organs, and they're just going like crazy. You know, the buddhi, Swamiji will say, the buddhi is drunk. He's getting drunk with desire and has let go of the manas, so the thing is just going crazy. So the one whose sense organs, you know, are just going on their own. There is no shanti at all, because you're just for a wild ride in terms of your raga dvesha. And then, also the one who is not a samahitaha, whose mind, because of desire, whose mind is not single-pointed, right? Samahita means the mind is contained. So first of all, the sense organs are not contained, but then the mind also is not contained, cannot be absorbed, cannot be single-pointed, because it wants many, many things. You know, Shankara says, he has a kind of a neat word for this. Anekagra manaha. Then he says it's vikshipta chittaha. The mind is really distracted. But what does that mean? That anekagra means, instead of being single-pointed, it's pointed in many directions. Aneka means many. We want what's called, so it's a kind of a play on words. We want a mind that has ekagra manaha. Ekagra manaha. Eka means one. Ekagra means it has a single point. Agra is like the tip of a blade of grass. So ekagra, the mind that is like single pointed, like the tip of a blade of grass, single pointed, as opposed to aneka. Aneka means many. So that mind, instead of being single-pointed on something, it's pointed in many directions. I want this, and I need this, and I want that, and I need that. That mind is asamahitaha. It is not single-pointed at all. In fact, it can't sit still. It's split. It's split in many directions because there's many, many different things that you need and want in order to be happy. In order to be happy is no joke. I'm talking about really to be happy, you know. The desire template goes like this, here's the template. and the positive. I want this. This can be anything. So I want this so that I can be happy. That's why I want it. That's why it's a desire. I don't just want it. I want it so that I can be happy. Right? Now, anekagra means the this is not this. I want these things, this list of things, right? I want this and then this and then this. Some are sequential and some are simultaneous. I want all of these things. And then I will be happy. And so now that mind is multidirectional. And such a mind is not samahita. It's not something that I can just withdraw into my being or something that can be single-pointed. Because it's competing. It's a mind that has competing desires. So that mind, he says, is vikshipta chitta. Vikshipta means it's agitated. The chitta, the mind itself, is all over the place. It's vikshipta. Vikshipta means like if I were, say I'm gardening and I have a handful of seeds and I'm just throwing them like this, you know. I'm spreading them all over the place. So say your mind is vikshipta like that, like you're spreading seeds. The mind is just going here, it's going here, it's going here, it's going here, distracted. Now he says, so that mind is not available for this knowledge, you know, because it has multiple desires. And the sense organs are running reckless. They're running wild, like a horse without reins. But then he says, Shankara says, for this next one, also, not just these things, but also, what if ashanta manasaha va api, the mind also can be not tranquil, because why? Shankara says, samahita chitta api, even when the mind is being single-pointed, right? It wants to have what he calls samadhana. The mind wants to practice samadhana. Samadhana means absorption, meditation, bringing the mind in a single-pointed state. But why does it want it? It wants the fruit of that. It wants the experience of that. So he says, samadhana pala artitva, because it's desirous of the fruit of that, it itself again becomes ashanta manasaha. It no longer has shanti, because it's doing it for a person, for a purpose. Like say if you've learned to meditate, I'm thinking like in the 60s and the 70s, okay? You learn to meditate, but with that meditation, you are supposed to experience something. You're supposed to have an experience. That's why you're meditating. You're working on gaining an experience. You want the pala of that act of, pala means fruit, the result of that act of meditating, okay? And so now you're meditating and meditating. Swamiji told me, before he understood Vedanta as a pramana, as a means of knowledge, this is what he was doing. He was meditating and meditating many hours a day with complete concentration till he said, I lost all my hair. He's bald. I lost all my hair doing this. It was so frustrating because no result really. You have little results, but they go away. You know, any meditative result that comes from your practice of concentration, you know, is a time-bound result. In fact, and this is so frustrating for people who are actually working to achieve something through meditation, to achieve a state of experience, the problem they have is that every state of experience which requires a particular type of vritti, particular type of thought modification, it is only a thought modification, that you have achieved a thought modification which will only last so long. Because it's a thought modification, because it's the mind. The mind doesn't reach a stage where it no longer has thought modifications. And so even your most profound absorptions will be so disappointing because you come out of them. So even in yoga, what they're thinking is that eventually they'll have what's called an anuvritti. Practice, 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 until they never come out. And then they never come out and the body drops, and then they are free, right? So this is, and then they say, you have to be very careful, because if you make a mistake, like a bouncing ball, the mind will come back down into samsara. So, very frustrating. And then also there's this type of hierarchy. How much time do you spend in samadhi every day? Is it every day, or do you only once or twice a week? How often do you get in that samadhi? And you get into the samadhi every time that you try? Yeah. So there's all of this kind of discussion that going on, trying to find something timeless and free in a time-bound condition. See what I mean? So that creates a lot of stress. And the mind also is not always in the mood for that. And so then the person becomes unhappy because it's not, the samadhanam is being used in order to produce a state of experience, which that itself creates a lot of pressure. And an active, he says, it creates what's called vyapritachitta, means a really active mind, because the mind is very engaged in trying to accomplish this result, which is just another raga, right, on a subtle level. So he says, so even that type of mind becomes ashanta manasa. That mind, for that person, all these are negatives. That person also, what are all these negatives? All this, such these people who suffer from these ailments. Says, prajnanena ena atmiyat. For such a person, ena, this self, the atma, cannot be achieved, cannot be gained through knowledge. Prajnanena. Jnana means knowledge. Prajnanena means correct knowledge, like vijnanam, where the recognition of myself, it can't be gained through this knowledge. But this knowledge, it's not, knowledge is, self-knowledge is not, self-knowledge is not at all an academic pursuit. You know, there is so much logic, so much things to understand, that all of the knowledge, all of the teaching is actually pointing you to the recognition of something. It's that recognition is the knowledge. It's where the self shines. Your own, the truth of what's being said shines. It presents itself to you because the knowledge has been pointing your mind, the teaching has been pointing your mind in that direction to recognize, to differentiate your own being from all of the things that you've taken it to be, right? All of the things, objectifiable things, subject, object, all these objectifiable things that you've totally identified with yourself as yourself. The knowledge as a pramana comes in and takes you step by step, by step, by step to recognizing you just as you are, your own nature. And recognizing that nature, the relationship of this whole creation to that. But that's something that is what we call aparoksha. Aparoksha means it's direct, immediate recognition. And any amount of logic will support that. But it won't give it to you. It won't give it to you because logic depends upon, you know, having relationships within the world. Logic will do a lot for you, you know. Inference will do, different types of inference will give you so much knowledge within duality because of the relationship, the invariable relationships between things that allow for that knowledge, inferential knowledge, to take place. But in this case, there is no invariable relationship that can, knowing this, you will know this. Right? It's like if I say, look, there's a fire on the hill, see the smoke. I don't see the fire, I see the smoke, but I know that that's smoke, and therefore I can infer the fire. So I can't, and so we use, because of these invariable relationships, we're able to make jumps like that. Even though you don't see the fire, you know that it's there because of the smoke. But here, in order to know the self, I can't say, oh, look at this, therefore there's a non-dual self. Look at this, therefore there's a non-dual self. It's not like that, you know. There is a non-dual self. The non-dual self is there. And so step by step by step, you can recognize it. And in recognizing that non-dual self, then there are all types of understandings that naturally come because of that understanding. But your inference within the world of invariable relationships is not going to take you there. That's why the Vedanta works as a pramana, and the only reason it can work at all is because you are already there as self-evident conscious being to be pointed at. That's why it can work. If it's not you, you know, that is ever present, there's nothing that can point to it. That's, Jung had this problem. He said, oh, in India they talk about it, you know, an infinite consciousness, but that's not me, and so who cares, you know? Because I'm not infinite consciousness. So they're saying there's an infinite consciousness, okay. Oh, what good will that do me? And he said they're very arrogant to even hypothesize such a thing because they have no way of knowing it. I certainly know I'm not infinite consciousness. I put that in my dissertation, that quote. He didn't have teaching. He did so much, so many very great, great things within duality in the world of the psyche. But and he was right too. I mean, within the means of knowledge he had available to him, that was a perfectly reasonable thing to say, you know. So, well, that's it. He did one verse. That's good. Swasti prajabhya paripalayantam nyayena margena mahim mahishaha ko brahmanebhya shubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukino bhavantu kale varshati parajanyaha prativesasya shalini desho yamsho varahitaha Pramana santu nirbhayaha Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha Sarve santu niramayaha Sarve bhadrani pashyantu Ma kaschid dukha bhag bhavet Asato ma sadgamaya Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya Mrityorma amritangamaya Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vishishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Hari Om.
So, Carol, I have a question. Because it has to do with Pratibandhakai.
Yeah.
Okay. So, this class was about. Well, it's about a lot of things, but my question about Pratibandhaka Jnanam is, okay, so if you have Pratibandhaka Jnanam, you have knowledge, but you're not really having the fruits.
Right.
Okay. So probably the reason you're not having the fruits, most likely, is like psychological issues, unresolved psychological issues, say. That's what that's why you're not
having it. Or the emotional lag time in terms of your own raga dvesha, your lack of vairagya.
Right.
But which so, is not, which is a little different so than just psychological issues. So both are there, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, okay. So, but say, like, so it's kind of parallel in a way to what you were talking about, except that it's different.
Yeah, it's different.
Mm-hmm. Because you want to resolve these issues in order that you gain something not temporary, right? I mean, because you want, because what are the fruits? The fruits are like peace and contentment, shanti, these kinds of things for the mind. So the self is unchanging. But you're working for the fruits. Do you know what I mean? So the fruits...
Yeah, that's subtle. I have to talk about it a little differently than yours, but go ahead.
No, I'm just sort of musing about it. I mean, it's kind of like you're doing this work that is about time-bound things, but ultimately why you're doing it, the reason that you're doing it is to appreciate more fully that timeless nature of yourself.
I'm going to say it a little bit differently.
Uh-huh.
Okay. The timeless nature of yourself is self-evident.
Yeah.
So it is its own experience, which is not being covered. It's always present. Okay. When the mind, as the mind gains this knowledge, there's two things that are there. One is the recognition of when you're gaining nishta, there's the recognition of your own presence differentiated from the mental states. So then, no matter what is going on or how silly your mind is acting or what type of depressions or hurts or inner child stresses and strains that are there, yourself is not covered. If when that's true, you're jnani, yourself is not covered, but the mind isn't living up to your knowledge. Right? It's acting still as an ajnani, even though yourself, the self that you are, is ever present and differentiated from the way that it's behaving. Now, this, what I call emotional lag time, is going to be there even without inner child, inner psychological problems, because it takes a while for the mind to catch up. Right, because it has so much habitual ignorance. And so the mind is slower in really owning up the knowledge than your like self-recognition. And so then that's why sometimes Shankara says, I think it's in chapter 13, and that was when he's going through the Amani Twin verses, I believe. He says, really the only one, and he says in chapter 5 also in this commentary, the only really one who really knows whether you have knowledge or not is yourself and your guru. Until the emotional qualities catch up with your knowledge. So that, and that means then that your way that you act and feel and think is really just an expression of the self. You know, it's not an expression of habitual ignorance or things that are slowly dropping off. Okay, so that's going to happen regardless for everybody. Then we have the other issue of unconscious complexes that require inner child work, or things that are unconscious that are what we call really pretty bandhakas to my own shanti, so that the mind, even if myself is there, the mind is still creating quite a bit of pain for me. You know, and that's a different order of handling than kind of the habitual ignorance, which is easier because I can just pull my mind back. But this inner, psychological complexes have to be handled on a different level. Learning how to do inner child work, learning how to be with those emotions instead of pushing them away, welcoming them and understanding them, that helps really a lot. then also sometimes if there's real issues, being in therapy helps, because sometimes you need to internalize the, what do you call it, like the empathy of the therapist, the good therapist. It replaces the good mother or the, replaces the bad mother. Also, the good therapist can replace the bad father. And whether it's a female or a male therapist, it can replace either one. You know, it just depends on what needs replacing. And sometimes that is very helpful. That's very helpful because the mind has been wounded and it needs that external person to interject, to do that type of actual replacement. And then you end up with that problem more or less being solved, and then you have a better relationship with your parents, actually. You know, even though the therapist has been interjected to replace and heal the negative interject of a negative parent. So there's all the psychological things that therapy can help with if when necessary. Therapy has a lot of very positive things that it can do within relativity because of damage. A lot of that we can do ourselves through the inner child work and if we learn how to do it.
So the idea is that so that the mind has the benefit of its knowledge.
It has pola. The mind itself has the pola of the knowledge. Because you will always still have the knowledge because of your own presence is differentiated.
Yeah.
But it's like your mind's in a thunderstorm or dark cloud all the time. Right. You know, which you don't want. You know, if that can be cured, then you want to do whatever it takes to cure it. Knowledge cures the fundamental problem, but sometimes there's psychological things that create pain and darkness in the psyche. And so then we have to take care. We go to a relative ways of taking care of that. Even all of the things we do for Antakarana Shuddhi are all within the relative world to bring about a relative shanti to the mind. That means Dharma becomes primary, and that Ishwararpana Buddhi, the relationship with Ishwar and all that thins out the problematic mind so that it can enjoy the fundamental problem being solved. The fundamental problem is that I think my Ananda is out there to be achieved instead of having recognized it as being my very being. When I recognize it as my being, then my mind now wants to be with me, not with the projected me. You know, and so that takes care of the problem. But then the mind itself can have some real pains and hurts that we have to deal with on a relative level. Yeah. Makes sense?
Yeah.
So I have some concern about even asking this question for that Danya's question touched on those same concerns, but I'm going to ask it anyway. So how would one, if one wants to develop more titiksha, and it's the motives for that that I'm concerned about, but if one wants to develop more titiksha, are there specific things for that as opposed to just the inner child stuff and all the antakarana shuddhi?
Well, I mean, it depends on, like the titiksha, usually...
Or just kind of flow naturally, you know, from...
You learn how to bring your, I mean, you do shravana, right? So that you continually engage, your mind is continually engaged in this knowledge because like, there's a lot of competition, like walking out the door. So there has to be some clarity that's taking place there that has layers to it. You know, layers of clarity, not just one layer. You need several layers of clarity. You know? Like Swamiji is the example of, like, if you're painting a picture, first you do like one big wide thing of blue for the sky, and then one wide thing of green, you know, so you have the basic vague thing, but then it all has to be filled in. You need to have a depth. Nididhyasana helps for you to assert, owning up, taking special time to own up yourself in slow motion. It's really shravana in slow motion, you know, when you do a guided meditation or something. But then, when that lack of titiksha comes up because you're in a reaction, then those are just, to me, all of those are sadhanas. Every time there's a reaction, it's a sadhana to just bring my mind back and then to figure out what's really bothering me. If it's just because habitual ignorance, then I can just bring my mind back to my knowledge. Bring my mind back means bring my knowledge in, and that brings my mind back. Or if there's some other issues, underlying issues, that's why you say something like, okay, what's this really about? What's really bothering me? Then you get into unconscious issues. So you just keep doing that work. Now, I don't know about what you call other motivations.
Wanting peace and happiness and...
I think...
Wanting moksha.
Yeah, but that's
a benign... And all the palas that...
Yeah, but you should be wanting that. And that's a desire. It can be painful because it's a desire, but we call it a benign desire because it actually gives the goods of a self that is not going to go away, you know. But the pola, the mind's owning up to that knowledge, is a natural process because to the degree that you recognize yourself as the source of ananda, that's not just intellectual, but you keep seeing it over and over in many, many different ways, your mind would rather enjoy the beautiful ananda of your being than get entangled in all of this stuff. It's just not worth it. Your mind doesn't want to go there anymore. Nothing's accomplished by it. It's not good for you. It's not good for anybody. Nobody benefits. And you don't want to do it anymore. You know, you'd rather just stay home with your knowledge and deal with the situation objectively, whatever it is.
It sounds like then that there's nothing particularly special about developing any of the six qualities versus the other, that what helps one helps all of them.
Yeah, that's true. They're all very interrelated. Yeah. Very interrelated, that's right. But see, the other thing is, like, to have a desire for just shanti, for a mind that doesn't bother you, is a benign desire to have if you know the answer, you know? Say if you want shanti, but you want it by fulfilling these and these and these desires. That is very agitating. That's really hard to get shanti in that way. Because everything has to work, right? You have to actually fulfill the desire, and then now you fulfill the desire, and then nobody should try to take it away from you. You know, and you shouldn't get bored with it either. You know, so there's all kinds of threats going on. Time itself is a time and change or a threat to any fulfilled desire. And so then your mind has to immediately go to the next thing you need. And I used to be shocked when I would fulfill some desire or another, and maybe within 15 or 30 seconds, the next desire would rise about now, but now I need this. I would just, once I remember thinking, gosh, give me a break. So fast. Yeah, well, major things, you know.
You spoke about meditation being so temporal and the illusion that people have around it. So then what is the use of it?
Well, the use of it, if we look at nididhyasana, you're meditating on something you know. Now you're not meditating for something to gain an experience. You're meditating on your own being. In order to give the mind a little space to get to know you rather than be you. Because the mind, there's that what we call anyonya adhyasa, that mutual superimposition, where the mind takes itself to be me, and then I gain all the qualities of the mind, and there's no viveka, there's no discrimination there. So now when we meditate, we're meditating on something we've seen clearly at the time of teaching, and owning that up. So it gives me some alone time with myself. in a way. When I'm used to just being, the mind is just used to being totally identified with itself and not recognizing the satya nitya relationship where myself is always the same, and it's the, but the mind totally depends upon me, it's always changing, I'm always the same. That means that I can come into relationship with that, and that becomes very, just my natural way of being, because I've recognized it. But habitually I'm used to not recognizing it. So once I recognize it, you know, then I'm, that's just how it is. I mean, I never think about anymore about recognizing that. It's never not recognized. But it's never not, but that's not the case until it has been recognized, you know. And then there's self-forgetfulness and just habitual ways of mind, and so you spend some time, you know, doing shravana and just spending time with yourself until the mind is assimilating the fact of it. And then that's not something that you
well,
have to
what
do.
What kind of suggestion could you make about this contemplation? We should do it every morning, or, I mean, there should be some small methodology with it.
I don't know, that that never worked for me.
Well, that's not, what?
Well, sometimes I would do Nididhyasana, sometimes for years I would not. You know, unless I was teaching and guiding it or something. So it just, it depends. I mean, I think it's a good thing to do if you, like, if you habituate yourself to it. I think, like, if we're doing a class, I think to do a meditation, a guided meditation is really good. And when you're listening, if you have time and you have a structure like that to sit and do Nididhyasana, I think that's a great thing. I think it's a problem if you tell yourself, as a rule, unless you're a controlling type, if you have that type of a personality that this works for you, if you think that I'm going to sit for a half, I have to sit for a half an hour every day, or somebody would say an hour every day, or half an hour in the morning, half an hour in the afternoon, or at night, that's what I have to do, then I would not like that. Because that seems like a really long time. Like when you start out, you know, I'm going to have to do this for a whole half an hour, then I just won't do it. That's why I always tell students, don't put a time limit on it. If you want to sit and contemplate forever, like however long you want to. And you can contemplate while you're walking along. Right? You can contemplate at any time. And if you know that there is not a time limit, then you don't have this dread when you sit down and know that you're stuck there for half an hour or an hour. And then it's just, you stop doing it. But if you don't feel like that, then you find yourself contemplating all the time. A contemplation actually becomes very natural. Whether your eyes are open or closed, you're always kind of resting in your knowledge, you know? People are different. I mean, some people, having that type of a practice works in a way that's natural to them. And for others of us, it doesn't work. Whereas for me, I mean, couldn't wait to get to every class Swamiji taught. You know? And then go to satsang afterwards. And then go home and study Sanskrit till I couldn't see anymore. So it depends on you, is what I'm saying. This knowledge is, for a mumukshu, this knowledge is primary. And so, but you have to kind of respect yourself, your mind, and what it's called asking you to do, what it wants to do around this knowledge, rather than trying to make it do things that it doesn't, can't do. Also, another thing is, it's really important to know how to do inner child work and work with the unconscious, because otherwise you're bypassing that and it's no fun. You're trying to have an absorbed mind with the little ones inside are all crying and wanting your attention. And so it's just boring. You're sitting there with an upset mind in the unconscious and just a flat, dull, unabsorbed, quiet mind in the conscious mind. And you're just sitting there with this quiet mind and So, you know, so what? When your mind is absorbed in that ananda, you feel so, just want to always be there. But even then, you can open your eyes and walk around and you're still there because it's you. You know, so it's really important to get the nuances right around this, or you're creating a big problem for yourself. And then you become rule-bound.
Yeah.
And then those rules are not any fun.
So it becomes kind of something that's natural to each person in their own way.
That's right. Because it's not like you don't know all of these things. You learn all of these things and you do all of these things. Yeah. And you know what works for you. And I mean, I hope as we teach the inner child work and all that, too. But that just becomes something natural that you don't even have to be meditating to do that. But when you're doing it, you can do it just to see how everybody's doing inside. To know so the psyche is settled because you're giving it that attention. All you have to do is ask.
You just
have to ask, how's everybody doing? You know, and follow feelings. Like if you have a feeling, to actually be with that feeling, talk to it, and know and have the skills to do that. Then that all those things take care of themselves because they regrow. You're healing all of those parts that have been kind of closeted by the defense system.
Is there a parallel between the mind that asks, how is everybody doing, and the self sort of beholding?
The what?
The self sort of, the way, I don't know how to say it, like, the self relating to itself, I guess.
Well, I would say there comes a time, we'll put it like this. The buddhi, right, is actually, buddhi means the intellect, is actually speaking for the self, right? And so with the little ones inside in the psyche, it's nice for the buddhi to say, does anybody have anything they want to say? Or if you're with an emotion, to talk to it, because you're in that kind of dual realm, right? But you also recognize that the buddhi, once it differentiates itself from the complex or the little ones inside, that buddhi then, as the subject, has for its content only the atma. Right? And so if the buddhi, when that's the case, the buddhi is very benign. It's just, it's a voice for me. And so go along with experience more or whatever, the little ones and everyone is really held by the self, whether you have the buddhi speaking or not. Right? But when necessary, the buddhi can speak because those words are useful to a part of the psyche that needs some words. You know?
Could you say all that again, just the last two sentences? I'm sorry. I faded.
The buddhi is really just a voice for the self, right? Because once it separates from subject-object, once the buddhi objectifies the emotion or the hurt part or the little one inside, then its content is the self because it's objectified the problem, right? So now the subject that it is just, it's, what's filling it is itself, and it's coming into relationship with the problem or the hurt or the unconscious or whatever. And so the buddhi can speak to the little ones or to the problem, whatever, you know, or not. Because once that differentiation is there, really it's what is holding what is wholly the problem or whatever is objectified is only your own being. So the buddhi is a voice for that that can be useful when necessary and not necessary when it's not necessary. Because everything has been objectified. So that just leaves me. And I know myself. So even as you know yourself, like as we do in meditation and the teaching and everything, you have that aparoksha, that self-evident me, is known. It has been differentiated from everything else. So I just simply am. I always am. I'm dominant in my psyche. Because there's never a part of any thought or any experience that's not filled with me. And that's known, so it's what I call dominant. Right? And so that means that whatever thoughts are coming in or emotions are coming in to me and my nature is healing by its nature. Right? But say there's some sort of a reaction or something, some little inner child or something is going on. Then the buddhi, objectifying that, can say, tell me what's hurting you.
I see, yeah.
And then it will come into dialogue and then it will talk, because it needs that. It needs somebody to talk to it. You know, whether it be a little child or an upset mind.
And it will talk. It will bring out the content.
Usually. If you ask it, if you talk to your feeling, say you have a feeling, and you talk to it and you say, what's really going on? Tell me. Yeah, I mean, you have to say it gently, like if you scream at it, like maybe your parents did or something, it'll just become more quiet and hide out even more. But if it trusts you and you talk to it, tell me what's really bothering you, then it'll tell you, and then you can be a good listener, you know?
That's the thing, like the voice is sort of slips into the old habit of how I was addressed, and so like with the content being the self, or if the buddhi is speaking for the self, like what would that voice, you know, how what would that holding be like? I guess
it would be non-judgmental. It would be welcoming. It would be like, say we're doing Nididhyasana, and you're just sitting with your being, and maybe I do a guided meditation and say, what are you like? Meaning the Atma, yourself. And so there's different words we can use, like totally non-judgmental, welcoming by nature, changeless, non-threatening. Abhayam is in sannyasa, the vyasa vow we do a lot on. Abhayam means it evokes, your being evokes no fear, nor is it afraid of anything. It's non-dual, you know, but just, so it's not going to be evoking or non, it's not going to be doing any action, but it's nature. Is its nature something that would make you want to, would repel you, or scare you, you know, or worry you? Is that its nature? We say, no, it's abhayam. It doesn't evoke, cannot evoke any fear whatsoever, nor can any fear come from it. And so it's got completely safe. Is it something, you could ask another question, is it the nature approachable? Or do you want to go away? You know, that means, is it safe? Is it welcoming? So you can have little phrases, like one I use was, it's like if something's happening and your mind is reacting or being bad or whatever you want to say about it, you can say, you know, it's okay, you can be with me. Even a person that is hard to handle because they're a hurtful, angry person or whatever it is, you can have that little mantra, it's okay, you can be with me. It means I don't have any need to push you away. Some of these little phrases, they have to mean something to you. Like if I were to say that to myself, it would mean nothing will ever happen to me to hurt you or for you to hurt me, so you can be here, it's fine. It just brings all my knowledge in just this one little phrase. Yeah. So you can have your own little phrase that works for you if you need it. Yeah. To stop you from, because There are scary monsters out there. Just like scary movies. Go to a scary movie. You know, Bhagwan has his own scary movies. They could be not scary for one person, but scary for another person, you know? The way somebody treats you or some scary thing, you know? So we have to be on our toes, as Swamiji says.
So I'm hearing you talk about, you know, buddhi.
Buddhi, yeah.
And being have a kind of affectionate awareness towards things. But it seems to me, in my experience,
yeah,
there's a kind of intensity of emotionally experiencing the whole catastrophe. You know, you're just like, and it's an intense process.
The whole catastrophe, that, I mean, if there's a catastrophe.
The whole thing, the whole catastrophe, the ego, all the you know, levels of neurosis, inherited, genetic, ethnic, worldwide, you know, that whole thing.
Yeah.
And then to feel it subjectively, for me, it's a pretty intense process.
It can be, but the thing is...
It's like, wow.
That's true. It can be really intense. The thing is because they can be intense in emotions, a lot of trauma, lots of stuff. But the question is, how are you with that intense emotion? Are you a friend to it? Are you a healing toward it?
Me? I'm willing to go through it, whatever it is.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. So far.
Yeah.
You know, terrible, seemingly terrible, whatever you're seeing.
Yeah.
At some level, I allow it, but it's also very intensive. But yeah, just to go through. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I think that that's good. Sometimes it helps when you're going through it is to discover, to have a friend inside. Like, for instance, something really intense is happening, and so you're just kind of experiencing that intensity, but internally there's nobody with you. There's not a good friend there, or somebody who cares. And so the buddhi actually has the capacity to divide into subject-object, to become aware of the really intense pain and trauma that's coming up, and be like a good mother in that situation, or a good father in that situation. That tends to be very, very healing, because that trauma that's coming up has a friend to contain it, an inner friend to contain it. Whereas, say we don't know how to do that, we do that in therapy, where the therapist becomes kind of the friend, or the one who's the benign witness to it. For healing, it helps to have a benign witness, even if it's internal, whether it's internal or external. It's just, if you think of it like an example, if a child is really screamed at or scolded by a parent, or very hurt, comes home, it's very hurt or whatever, and the parent just says, just go to your room, you know, don't come near me, go to your room, then there's no container there for that hurt. And that's re-traumatizing. There's no healing in that, there's just hurt. Whereas, say the child comes home and they're very hurt or whatever, and then the parent stays with them, you know, and loves them, and is with them as they work through that whole thing. That's much more healing. So you can have that type of inner relationship when these traumas come up and when you're doing that work, and it tends to not at all make the work less intense. It's still intense because it's intense, but there's also someone inside that cares. And that's because you've learned how to make that little subject-object split. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, for me, I just allow it, and I trust that whatever it is,
it'll be fine.
It'll be fine. It could feel like, you know, Kali's stomping on my chest or something. That's okay.
Yeah.
I mean, but I've got to go through that.
Yeah, but that means that that's kind of the observing ego, if I can use that technical term, is okay with it. And so give space for that. Is giving space for that to take place. So there's a subject object there, because you are giving space for this thing to happen, which allows it to happen in some safety, because you are saying this is okay. I'm willing to go through this.
I was going to say a little bit more. For some years, I guess I was on the spiritual path, and then I got off, so-called off the path.
Yeah.
So, okay, I'm going to explore something else. And because it was coming up, ignorance. How big is this? How wide is it? And then just forgot about spiritual stuff. But then that turned out that was a spiritual process, but that was, you know.
That was a spiritual process, too.
Sure. Yeah. But it was just years of, how far is this continent? How big is it? You know, it's just, it's big.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
See, understand.
So we're essentially talking about how to make the wounds in the psyche have less control over your mind.
Well, I would say you can say it like that, but another way to say it is to.
Yeah.
How to provide an environment, internal environment, to where those traumas can be worked through in a way that is healing, instead of a way that is re-traumatizing.
Because they seem to dull the your Vedantic knowledge about your own self.
Until they don't.
Because
there is it's that. It's like, say, you're in the middle of a big reaction. You kind of find yourself committed to that reaction. You're in it, you're committed to it. For as long as that lasts, until you can get a distance on it and then come into a relationship with it. You feel justified or whatever.
Well, you've made the distinction before, but you're committed more to your ignorance than you are to your knowledge.
Well, it takes a while for your knowledge, the head of your knowledge, to rise because of the size of the reaction. That changes over time, though.